a little bit taller, a lot stronger, just plain better.
The Night Air.
No, I've never heard of that.
It's like one giant construction site.
Radio National.
You can kind of get lost in that.
Get your coat on, we're going into town.
Part 8 of your conducted tour.
Hi and welcome to The Night Air on ABC Radio National. I'm Brent Clough. And tonight, we're going to town. In fact, visiting a few of them. Manchester, Leicester, New York and Dubai. We get a view of urban planning and talk to some of the residents of Hull, which in 2004, when the British literary magazine The Idler called on its readers to nominate the worst city in Britain, took the number one spot in The Idler's first book of crap towns.
All right, just this guy from Australia is asking questions on how old.
The neon vines are all ablaze, the street alive with people.
You sort us out a couple of dollars, whatever you call it.
It's not vulgar, it's quite beautiful.
Oh, it does. See you in a bit, Darren. Ta-ra, lads.
I think it's like cities across the world. I mean, this model of development, you'll find it in Baltimore and you'll find it in Barcelona. I'm sure you've got it in Australia, waterfront developments, museums, you turn your local history into heritage, you open up the streets, you change the licensing hours, you foreground the leisure and music industries. So although some of it's kind of unique to Manchester and the music scene's very vibrant here and it's probably had some kind of international presence, I think the rest of this model you could find in cities across the world. It's not so unique.
You're listening to Broadband on ABC Radio, and this evening we're talking about the planning and development of cities with Hugh Stretton of the University of Adelaide.
Broadcast in Sydney on the 26th of 3rd, 79.
Well, if you want to know whether there's good urban planning going on, you must usually go and find their poorest people and their poorest parts and see how bad they are.
Sort us out a couple of dollars, whatever you call it. No, but I've said that, Dad. I've said there's not for the kids. All it is just ball cameraed up everywhere. There's no to do.
You are wandering around in a daze.
For years, every time I returned to my native city, one of the first things I saw was a huge hoarding on the platform at Leicester Station, bearing the legend, Shonky Brothers Real Estate Agents.
This town is coming like a ghost town.
New York real estate tycoon Donald Trump is as well known for his plain speaking as his extravagant lifestyle and that Bondi-like bouffant.
He could make some of himself, that guy. He's got it clued up to the max, yeah. He really has.
And so it is that the New Yorker has his unique way of describing the architectural failings of the building that's proposed to be constructed on the World Trade Center site in the Big Apple.
It is the worst pile of crap architecture I've ever seen in my life, and I don't think we have to live with it.
Effective urban planning, of course, can be done for all sorts of evil purposes.
Oh, that's rubbish, rubbish. Well, yeah, am I lying to you now?
The billionaire property tycoon wants the designers and architect of Freedom Tower fired.
We want to rebuild the World Trade Center as the World Trade Center. A little bit taller, a lot stronger, just plain better.
Thinking back, most of us then knew little of Leicester's new immigrants, who they were, what they believed in, and most of all, why they'd chosen Leicester, an industrial city in the middle of England, which most people seemed only too keen to pass by, quickly at that.
And so it was with Hull.
Right, living in Hull, it comprises at the moment of an up-and-coming society of, let's say, heavier narcotics than was included before. It seems to me that we're turning into the Bronx.
Yeah, it is a huge party city. It's something that people don't really realise given the alcohol restrictions, but there are so many Western expatriates there that it does feel like you're in a kind of mad theme park.
Sredin has recently had published, and just released in Australia, a small volume on urban planning.
That sheer magnificence of the vision is startling, but it also has a kind of erasure where it's difficult to get a sense of the Arab culture.
Stretton roughly groups cities into either rich or poor, or capitalist or communist.
I was in Dubai in January this year, and I've been studying other kinds of what I term new frontier cities, so cities like LA, Vegas and the Gold Coast. I saw them as kind of typifying the nexus of leisure, tourism, entertainment and construction. And I thought Dubai was a logical extension of that, a kind of mothership of growth, acceleration and that irreverent expression. But when I got there, I changed my mind and I see it as a kind of Death Star.
And Stretton suggests that whilst urban planning obviously is closely entwined with a range of social and economic questions, both within the city and at a national level, there's one basic need which is inseparable from urban planning, and that is housing.
I remember coming over here when I was nine, and I thought, what an awful place to come to. We were in back-to-back houses, the toilets were outside, we had no bathroom in the house. I thought, why on earth have we come here? And I asked my father when I was older why we'd come here, and he said, well, the grass is greener elsewhere, always, and you always have to believe that, otherwise you wouldn't do anything.
Others dwell on how Hull is a national leader in teenage pregnancy, fatness, cancer, educational failure. The lists go on. And just when you're bracing yourself for the next bit of bad news, you hear something that doesn't get a mention anywhere in the Book of Crap Towns. But it's so intriguing, it somehow makes Hull irresistible. It is this. The London-based Australian poet, Peter Porter, is said to regard Hull as the most poetic city in England.
I think it was a mistake for the profession of planners 20 and 30 years ago to go to great lengths to separate questions of planning from questions of housing. They seem to me nearly always to go together in an integral way.
Let the rhythm work for you.
But this is especially doubly true in poor cities. People are actually going to die there if they haven't got the first things that planning can provide for them. Poor countries are always going to be poor, that's true.
Let the rhythm work for you.
And most of them are trying hard to make progress along a path that means that they revolutionise their agriculture and start developing an urban industrial structure both at the same time. And that's bound to dislocate people from their traditional places of living.
It was quite a romantic place, in like one of these glorious terminal declines.
In Britain, urban planning and housing has been developed within a fairly elaborate administrative and governmental framework.
Every day we fetch water for the household. It's a long walk, but we shorten the distance by singing or gossiping amongst ourselves.
And there's been the planned construction of entirely new towns. In general terms, how does the British experience compare?
Between chores we love to skip. The skipping becomes more and more complicated and difficult as we go on. Boys can't skip.
I came here at night by train to visit some friends.
Boys can't skip.
And pretty much the last half an hour was in complete darkness. There were no lights at all. And I'm just like, where are we going? And then suddenly you just see this great bridge, like some huge doorway. And you're thinking, well, wherever I'm going, I've arrived.
Surplus people sloshing about and very often gathering together around the outskirts of the big cities where the prospects are not good, but they're at least not as bad as they are in the country.
It had a kind of a substantive Labour council that didn't really know what they were doing, and they were embarked on a kind of a piecemeal operation to clear a lot of the old Victorian housing stock. So what hadn't been bombed by the Germans, they pretty well destroyed over a 5 or 6 year period.
Squatters get a plot of land and put up a tar paper shack or build something out of old kerosene cans. They can do it on a bit of land of which they've got secure tenure, so that as the years go by, as you get a bit of economic growth, as people improve these structures that they've built for themselves, they can look forward to continuous growth, you know, they can go on improving that property.
See those little, that look like fishing rods that stick out the corner of the buildings, the high-rise flats, 14 stories up. You can pick out exactly what you're reading out your newspaper from this distance.
What, us here?
Yeah.
You reckon we're being watched?
Yeah, you can, yeah. You can see how many whiskers you've got on your chin from that distance. No, I'm not.
Sure.
Kidding?
Yeah.
Really? Honestly, it's Big Brother, it's George Orwell.
What happens if you don't do it is that people camp all over the land, any old how, and the minute you want to run a sewer through it or run a decent road through it, you start having to bulldoze it and throw people off the plots that they've settled on for months or years behind.
Hang on to your tickets, hang on to your valuables. Here we go. All right.
Your round town in the night air on ABC Radio National.
The one memory that remains with me is my mother. I had been used to six servants in India. Everybody who's middle class in India would have five, six, seven, eight servants. We had six. And she was used to having the potatoes peeled, the toilet cleaned, the house cleaned, everything done for her. She never had to lift a finger. And she came over here and found there were no servants, not even one. And she was amazed. And if my father had told her that she would be coming to a back-to-back house with no toilet inside, she'd have to go outside in the cold and the rain, there'd be no bathroom in the house, and there'd be no servants, she'd have to do everything herself, she would never have come.
Philip Larkin spent the last 30 years of his life running Hull University's library before his death in 1985, aged 63. Professor John Osborne knew him briefly in his last years and is now working on a Larkin biography in an office in the heart of Larkin's old stamping ground. Even the building where we meet is named after the dead poet.
He comes across sometimes as a bit of a misery.
Yes, though, of course, famously, he's also a man who people say is the funniest man they ever met, and he's famously a poet who most people find cheers them up to read. So there's a funny thing going on there, though indeed, if you think of other art, it's not that unusual. Say you think of the blues, and Larkin was a great jazz fan and a famous jazz critic. You don't listen to the blues to get depressed. You listen to these songs which speak about depression, but in such a way that the artistry of it and the vigour of it, in a funny sense, defeats the blues by expressing them, by giving voice to them. And I think, in a way, Larkin's poems, if they have a model, would be the blues. One of the most famous living Australian poets is Peter Porter, and he said of Hull that it's the most poetical city in the United Kingdom. Now, anybody who comes here thinking from that description that it's going to be some sort of beautiful Venice of the North is going to be disappointed. So what Peter Porter must have meant, I think, is that somehow or other there were an awful lot of poets in Hull, perhaps more proportionate to its size than in any other city in the United Kingdom. Now, Larkin's the most famous, and he's considered with Ted Hughes one of the two best English poets of the second half of the 20th century. But the famous Liverpool poet Roger McGough started in Hull. The famous Irish poet Tom Paulin was a student at Hull University. The famous, perhaps the most famous living Scottish poet Douglas Dunn, a great friend and admirer of Les Murray, the Australian poet, he was in Hull for 20 years. Andrew Motion, the poet laureate, lived in Hull.
Hull's clearly moved on in terms of its image of itself, and it's trying to draw itself up and create investment and to polish up its act, if you like. For my part, I think there are many downsides about Hull. I think Hull people, of which I'm not one, are very self-deprecating to the point of the absurd. I mean, to vote yourself the crappiest city in the country.
They did that themselves.
They did that themselves. It seems to be A, an act of folly, and B, a kind of two-fingered gesture at almost anything. There's a nihilism, I think, about that. People don't say, welcome to Hull. They say, what are you doing in Hull?
When they talk about it's raining, they say it's sailing down.
I've got some of
what they say. Oh, that's rubbish, rubbish. I'll bray your head in, yeah. Shut your gob.
Fewer people go to church in Hull than any other place in the country. Now, I think that's magnificent.
So, yeah, basically that's it. You do go to other towns and you think, oh, how obstinate you are.
The Book of Crap Towns doesn't just pick on the impoverished. It also attacks self-satisfied Middle England. Historic tourist destinations like Oxford and Winchester make the top 50, as does London. Even definitions of what constitutes the outer boundaries of the modern metropolis are changing.
Tape out in. This is cut 2. Off broadband number 394, broadcast 16th of 4, 79, life in a Berber village in Morocco. End ID.
Quite different sorts of problems confront planners and populations in industrially developed Western cities. The steep rise in the price of urban land through the 60s has done little or nothing for economic efficiency, distributing land to the richest users, not to the most efficient or profitable, and it's a problem that's been tackled intelligently in very few countries. The clearing of large tracts of urban housing for freeways, more suitable for long-distance country travel, has not improved urban life either. In the United States, the preferred lifestyle for most is a house in the suburbs. And yet one-third of the population of that country is unable to share in that life or to live in what is an acceptable alternative to it. Hugh Stretton.
It's something Australians, I think, would do well to grasp with the possibilities of our urban housing policies in mind. I don't hold much of a brief for the suburbs, actually, but there's no doubt that high proportions of populations, not just in America and Australia, but all over the well-developed world, like to live in the house and garden style. In America, there's been very little public assistance to this, except some tax concessions to mortgage lending. And the result is that about two-thirds of Americans live in a house and garden style, and the others are rather decisively excluded from it. They divide between people living in the old ghetto parts of the cities and people who would like the suburbs but can't get the mortgage money and who are served up various kinds of caravan and portable and temporary housing instead. The great advantage of that sort of housing is not that it's any better, it's not, it's universally rather worse, and it's not that it's any cheaper for the people in it. It's, on the whole, costs about the same as solid suburban housing. The great advantage of it for the relevant investors and trades is that if you sell somebody a portable house on somebody else's land, the whole transaction can yield higher purchase rates of interest instead of mortgage rates of interest. It's much more profitable for the suppliers. On the whole, there are higher profits in flogging portable houses than in building solid ones. There are much higher profits in financing portable houses on higher purchase terms than in financing solid houses on the sort of terms that you have to charge for long-term mortgages.
How could there have been so much highly paid expertise which gave such effectively bad advice?
Let's say roughly that they were totally out of my notion of time. You know, my notion of time was I do this, I do that, I've got to go there, I've got to make this. But they were just living, and time for them was just the time of their birth and time of their death. In the middle, they were just in agreement, total agreement with nature. Nature was their clock.
And again, the English are a good example. That's perhaps the bad side of the English performance since the Second World War.
they've had some of the worst of what you might call stupid technocracy. They turned over from their traditional styles of public housing, which tended to be semi-detached, to a general policy of building high-rise skyscraper flats for their working classes heavily through the late 1950s and above all the 1960s.
Any new experience that the villagers undergo must be interpreted in terms of the book. If the book fails to do that, then the potential for breakdown of the society occurs. The old man no longer has the authority that's been given him by owning the book. He can no longer describe the reality the people see.
And the people who persuaded him to do that were very scientific-looking folk, and they had a plausible theory. And the theory said, you can't afford to go on sprawling all over the land the way you've been doing. You must pack people into your cities more densely, and if you do, you'll get all sorts of advantages, they said. People live closer together, that'll be more sociable and more urbane and more like the boulevards of Paris and less like the rotten suburbs. And it'll also be much cheaper because you'll economize all your services, won't you? You'll economize shorter sewers, shorter lengths of wire, shorter lengths of road and so on. And you'll get fabric which is better to maintain because it's consolidated like that, and easier and cheaper to heat and service because it's consolidated. And you'll get more sociable city life.
Now, if you move too much and ask too many questions, then you disturb their reality. Yes. They adopt you, they accept you, they give you a place to sleep and give you the food, and you work with them. So you participate, you are a member of the village for the time they decided to have us with them. But going further and investigating would have put us in the skin of nearly of somebody looking at an insect, you know, and trying to see the comportment, the behavior of the insect under any condition. And we were unable to do that. We were not even thinking of it.
They didn't believe that. If you'll forgive the phrase, they were a pack of hypocritical bastards, because scarcely one of the technocrats who recommended these policies ever consented to live in those circumstances himself. And I say himself because there were no women among them ever. And not surprisingly, since it began from hypocritical assumptions, it was very sloppy and careless and often downright incompetent in its technical parts, where the technocrats should have been competent. They're now proving 6 or 8 times as expensive to maintain, you know. They're having to put whole new skins on a lot of those high-rise towers at greater expense than it cost to build them in the first place. What was really bad about that technocracy was that it thought that if you could calculate economies in just a very few of the aspects of city life, just say your sewers and your roads and your transport costs, you should revolutionize your cities just to achieve a better equation on that front. Standing off and saying, what is it really going to be like for men and women and kids with all the daily concerns that people really do have to exist in those conditions? Will it be good? It's sort of salutary to remember that nearly all houses are produced, well, they're produced in the following way. Somebody lends money, the price of the house. Somebody occupies the new house and pays that debt over time. Now, whether the occupant who pays the debt gets to own the house and therefore gets to be the possessor of $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 worth of capital wealth, that's not really an economic question. It's a sort of administrative question. Sometimes the occupant who's going to pay for the house can convince the bank or the building society to lend him the money so it can be his house and he can be the owner. Other times he can't. Somebody else has to do the convincing, a private landlord or a state housing trust or something like that. And in that case, a third party who really contributes nothing to the business ends up owning the wealth. I don't know why people are so keen to expand private landlording. It performs certain very important services for certain classes of people at certain times of their life, but why anyone would want private landlording for the mass of family households, I don't know. I would like to restore the situation where whatever housing finance there is available as first call, so to speak, to the private household.
Question 65. Are your opinions insufficiently important to tell other people?
I can see her hobbling alone along the rim of the slight declivity that was part of the physical relief of the backyard. Dark glasses and shawl at mid-morning, refusing. A plank of wood made grey and riven and insensible by weather and time. A pane of glass so old that its inherent viscosity had become evident. Time and gravity leaching all the strength out of it, leaving it thin and brittle and strange. A field of green linoleum flecked with colours, each fleck 3/4 of an inch across, each one a vast expanse to be traversed by the minuscule explorers I would strand there. These things were more immediate. Shreds of dry and chalky paint hung flayed and barely alive from the ceilings of some rooms. A small chip in a door frame revealed multi-hued strata of coats and undercoats and primers applied over and again down through the decades. Humble dustings of mildew enlivened the walls of other rooms. Sandstone was still a crumbly thing, a friable thing compared to brick. She's still there, hobbling, alone, refusing. Things and humans, old and invalid, acquire an imperiousness all their own. As time passed, my grandmother became increasingly frail, afflicted by chronic rheumatism and an increasingly painful sensitivity to light. So she had to be moved underground. She lived on for several years by the light of a shaded 20-watt bulb, listening to 2FC on a small but sturdy transistor radio. Its prominent circular tuning mechanism spattered like the sky at night with the call signs of all states and territories. The arrangements we were obliged to make for her were the astonishment of visitors unfamiliar with us and the food of gothic visions in the already superheated imaginations of my pubescent high school friends. One of our teachers at the time told us once this 19th century aphorism, provenance unknown, but more than likely the responsibility of a non, historically the world's most prolific author. An idea will remain strange against the inevitable day when we have exhausted ourselves of its peculiarities. Just as no idea will ever attain the condition of strangeness until the day contingent upon our seeing its peculiarities standing revealed before us, perhaps for the first time, perhaps once again.
Do the ACA.
You've been listening to a Towns edition of The Night Air on ABC Radio National, where the locations visited include Craptown, Too Good for England, and Another Country, both from Radio I, Rebuilding Ground Zero from Rear Vision, Dubai from By Design. The interview with Hugh Stretton and the Berber Village piece came from the ABC radio program Broadband, with thanks to ABC Archives. You also heard another in our series, Do the OCA, written and read by Patrick Gibson. Towns was developed by Diane Dean and its amenities designed by John Jacobs. I'm Brent Clough, and for more details you can go to our website at this address, abc.net.au/rn/nightair, where you can also download our most recent shows in hi-fi stereo. Catch you next week.
Ha ha, lads.
The night air.